This chapter 9, actually only has one formula in it, and the rest is jargon. What's going on in the next three chapters, chapters 9, 10, and 11, is that we're easing our way into statistics from probability. In chapter 9, we assume that we know the mean and the standard deviation. That is, we assume that we know mu and sigma. Now, if that were true, we would not need data. In the next chapter, we'll assume that we know sigma, the standard deviation, but we do not know the mean. That's a very unrealistic combination, but it'll help us, again, introduce more terminology, more jargon. Finally, in chapter 11, we tackle a real-world case where the mean and the standard deviation are both unknown. Okay, so right now I'll introduce right away the one new formula for this whole chapter. We let z equal to x bar minus mu over sigma over the square root of n. Okay, so the only difference between this and the other z transformation is the square root of n term. X bar is the sample mean, so the mean from a sample that we take. Mu is the population mean. Sigma is the population standard deviation. And the square root of n is the square root of the sample size. N is the sample size. Okay, so let's back up a minute and define some terms. I said that most of this chapter is about jargon. Okay. Important distinction is between a parameter and a statistic. A parameter is a property of an entire population. That could be the average height of 15-year-old girls in the entire population. A statistic is an estimate based on a sample. You could take a sample of 12 15-year-old girls and take their average height, and that's a statistic. We call the parameter for the mean, we usually use the letter mu, the Greek mu. For the statistic of the sample mean, we usually use the expression x bar, x with a bar over it. For the standard deviation, for the parameter, we usually call it sigma. For an estimated standard deviation based on a sample, we use s. The parameter is typically unknown to the investigator. So that's a very important characteristic of a parameter. We don't know what it is. Statistic is something we find. So we take a sample, we do a calculation, and we found out what our statistic is. We don't know the true population parameter, but we do know the statistic. So for example, get this idea of the unknown parameter. No one knows, if you go back to the election in 2000, if you remember, in Florida there was this controversy. Did Bush win in Florida? Did Gore win? And it took several weeks of arguing and several court decisions and the whole thing. The unknown parameter in that election is how many people actually meant to vote for Gore when they pushed the button. Remember, there were all these issues. There was a ballot that looked strange, so supposedly some people who meant to vote for Gore ended up voting for Buchanan. And then there were people who might have meant to vote for Gore, but they didn't push the button hard enough, and so there were these hanging chads. That was the famous phrase of that time. The holes didn't get punched all the way through on the ballot. So no one knows how many people actually meant to vote for Gore in Florida in 2000. That is an unknown parameter. But it turns out we have lots of statistics. We have exit polls. We have the first vote tabulation. We have recount. We have another recount. We have a study by the newspapers. Several newspapers got together and studied the ballots afterwards. So we have all these different statistics about that unknown parameter. Another example of an unknown parameter would be what the hemoglobin count is for all of your blood. Well, we're not going to look at all of your blood to try to find out. What they'll do is they'll prick your finger or take a sample out of your arm, and then do a count of that sample, and then use that as an estimate of how much hemoglobin is in your blood. So this distinction between parameter and statistics is really all around us. Whenever we do statistics, there's a true parameter, which we don't know, and then there's a statistic, which we do know, and which we try to use to estimate the unknown parameter. Okay, the next topic is the issue of bias. What is a biased estimate or an unbiased estimate? As a statistician, you prefer to have an unbiased estimate of a parameter. A biased estimate is not very helpful. Now, any statistic is going to have an error. That is, for example, all of those vote counts in Florida, since no one knows what the true parameter is, each of those vote counts was simply an estimate of the true parameter. But what we're looking for, the best you can hope for, is unbiased statistic, an unbiased vote count. So an unbiased means that on average, the statistic will be right. In mathematical terms, we say that if the expected value of x bar is equal to mu, then x bar is an unbiased estimate of the true mean. So what's an example of an obviously biased estimate? You often get biased estimates when you take surveys for a variety of reasons, and there are a lot, we'll talk about that next semester. We'll talk about some of the sources of biases in surveys. But a pretty typical bias is a magazine will take a survey of readers and ask them how many sex partners they've had, let's say, in the last 5 years or something like that. And the magazine will report with a perfectly straight face that men have five times as many sex partners as women. But we can show that that's biased because just imagine that you had an omniscient voyeur who stood around and counted every time a couple hooked up. So every time there was a sexual relationship, the voyeur would make a tally and say, "Oh, there's another one." And suppose that the voyeur knows the true number of relationships n, and then we know the number of males m, and we know the number of females f. So all the omniscient voyeur has to do to calculate the average number of male sex partners is to divide n, number of relationships that the voyeur spotted, by m, and the average number of female sex partners, n divided by f. Since m and f are about the same, one average cannot be five times the other. So either the estimate that males report is high, the estimate that females report is low, or both. So that's just an example of a biased estimate. So when you're designing a study, you want to design one that's unbiased. Another example of apparently biased estimates was the exit polls that took place in the 2004 election, because some of the exit polls that got released on over the internet said that John Kerry had won the election. In fact, Bush won it pretty decisively, which suggested to a lot of people that the polls were biased. Perhaps they were not sampling enough Republican voters somehow. But clearly, there was some kind of bias in those poll estimates. And that's another example of the real-world problem of that you often encounter of biased estimates. Okay, let's go on to the central limit theorem, an important theorem that you'll have to, there's always, at the very least, a question of, or two in the multiple choice on the AP on it, and sometimes you're asked about it indirectly in the free response as well. Okay, so if you shoot at a target, even though you're unbiased, you may still miss, and the amount by which you miss is called the sampling error. And the central limit theorem states that if you use the sample mean to estimate the unknown population mean, then as the sample size gets large, the distribution of x bar will be normal. The expected value of x bar will equal mu. the variance of x bar will get smaller. And in fact, the standard deviation of x bar will approach the population standard deviation divided by the square root of the sample size. Remember at the very top, we had that formula, x bar minus mu over sigma over the square root of n. That sigma over the square root of n comes from this central limit theorem. Note that the underlying population does not have to have a normal distribution for the central limit theorem to apply. In some ways, that's the exciting thing about the central limit theorem, is it doesn't matter where you're sampling from as you take a large enough sample size, your sample mean will, the errors around it will be normally distributed. In fact, that's a general reason why the normal distribution is so important, because errors tend to be normally distributed. That is, you tend to have occasional large errors, but mostly small errors. So measurement errors of various sorts tend to be normally distributed, and in particular sampling error, that is the error that you get by taking a sample rather than looking at the whole population, tends to be normally distributed. And the standard deviation falls with the square root of the sample size. So the larger the sample you get, the less likely you will make a large error. So when people are taking polls, the larger the poll, the smaller the expected error. Okay, so then the last point of the theorem states that the mathematically that sigma of x bar is equal to sigma over the square root of n. That is, it's equal to the true population standard deviation divided by the square root of the sample size. So remember the one formula that we have from this chapter, z equals x bar minus mu over sigma over the square root of n. Well, how do we end up using that? Well, let's take an example. Suppose we take a sample of 9 girls from a population where, again, we're in this chapter 9 world where we know the true population mean is 64, and in this case, in the true standard deviation, let's say, is 3. What is the probability that the average in our sample will be less than 63 inches? So we're calculating the probability of getting someone who's a sample average of less than 63. That is the average of all 9 girls being less than 63 inches. Now, if we were doing one girl, we would simply do x minus mu over sigma. We'd take 63 minus 64 over 3, and then that would give us a z, and then we would do a norm CDF of whatever we got there. In this case, the difference is because we're taking the sample average, we take sigma over the square root of n as the denominator. So instead of 63 minus 64 over 3, it becomes 63 minus 64 over 3 over 3, or 63 minus 64 over 1, or minus 1 over 1 is minus 1. Now we take the norm CDF from minus 100 to minus 1, and we get 0.16, so we would say there's a 16% chance that in a sample of 9 girls, the average height will be less than 63 inches. Another question you could ask is, how large a sample would you need to make the probability of getting an average less than 63 inches less than 0.05? That is, we want to shrink that probability from 0.16 to 0.05, and we can do that by taking a larger sample. This is a problem that looks like a case of the missing sigma type problem. That is, we're really trying to reduce the standard deviation of our estimate. And we can reduce the standard deviation of our estimate because it depends on sample size. It depends on n. So we're solving for n, but the approach is sort of like a case of the missing sigma approach. So we start out with the INS norm of 0.05, because that's our target. We want to have a 5% chance of getting the result. And the INS norm is negative 1.64. So we throw a negative 1.64 into our z equals x bar minus mu over sigma over square root of n formula. So we have negative 1.64 is equal to 63 minus 64 over 3 over the square root of n. Now we're solving for n here. We're solving for the sample size that will give us this result. And so we get 4.92 is equal to square root of n. So we square both sides, and we get an n of about 25. That is, the sample size of about 25, we can reduce the probability of getting a sample average below 63 inches to less than 5%. That's what we just did there. Okay, the next topic is the normal approximation to the binomial distribution. It turns out that even if the underlying distribution is binomial, we can use the normal distribution to give us an approximation of what we can expect. So in this case, the true parameter is p, that is the probability of success, but we do take a sample and we get a sample proportion p hat. So this would be a classic case of doing a poll. If we did a poll and the true percentage of Democrats might be 47%, in our sample we might observe that it's 48% or 45%, whatever we observe. The mean of p hat is p. That is, we expect, because of the central limit theorem, that our sample, as long as it's an unbiased sample, will have a mean, that the long average will hit the true parameter. The standard deviation of our sample mean, or of p hat, is the population standard deviation divided by the square root of the sample size. And the population standard deviation is the square root of p times 1 minus p. So we take the square root of p times 1 minus p over the square root of n. Something to note, okay, so now we have the square root of n in the denominator. You notice that when we did n binomial trials, the standard deviation of the mean number of successes, we multiplied by n. We took the square root of np times 1 minus p. But that's where we're What we're looking around at is the standard deviation of the mean number of successes in n trials. Here we're taking the average, and we're looking of n trials. So we're not, so we're taking the number of successes in n trials k and dividing it by n to get p hat. And that's why n now shows up in the denominator, in this case, the square root of p times 1 minus p over n. Okay, next, let's see how this works. Suppose we want to use the normal approximation to figure out the probability that Kobe will hit no more than 70% in 64 free throws. Suppose that Kobe is an 80% free throw shooter. What's the probability that Kobe will hit no more than 70% in 64 free throws? Okay, back in Chapter 8, we would have just used binom CDF. He's going to shoot 64 free throws, that's n. 0.8 is the probability of success, and then we want no more than 70% of them, so we take 70% of 64, and that's about 49. So we could use that as a Chapter 8 way of doing it. The Chapter 9 way of doing it is to treat the distribution as approximately normal. Okay, the distribution of the, in this case, of his percentage. So we're focusing on his percentage. Is he going to shoot 80%, 70%? What's he going to shoot? And with a mean of 0.8 and a standard deviation of the square root of 0.8 times 1 minus 0.8 over 64, that is, we're using the normal approximation. So we divide by 64, and that's inside the square root sign. And so that all comes out to be 0.05. So now we calculate a z value. We take 0.70, which is the kind of the question, will we hit any more than 70%, minus 0.80 over this sigma over square root of n, which is now 0.05, is equal to negative 2. Okay, so we've got a z value of negative 2. Then we take a norm CDF from minus 100 to negative 2, and we get 0.023, or 2.3% probability that Kobe will hit less than 70% of 64 free throws. Okay, so that's using the normal approximation to the binomial distribution. All we're doing is we're using the mean and then the standard deviation adjusted for sample size for this proportion of successes. We're plugging that mean and that standard deviation into our chapter 9 formula, z equals x minus x bar minus mu over sigma over square root of n. And then we're just doing the normal calculations, the norm CDFs from that point on. Now, the normal approximation is actually most useful when we need to solve for n, because the binomial CDF won't really help with that. So that's really why well, there are two reasons actually why this normal approximation developed. One was binomial CDF is a very complex function that and people didn't have calculators in the old days, so the normal approximation was a calculation shortcut. Nowadays, though, if you were trying to solve for the sample size you need to get a certain probability that you would be within a certain percentage of the mean. So let's say we wanted the probability that Kobe hits at least 70% to be, let's say, 98%. We want a very high probability of that happening. The question is, how many free throws is he going to have to shoot in order to make sure that that's going to happen? That's a solving for n problem. And to solve for n, we would really need to actually have the mathematical formula to do that problem. Again, the final point I want to make is that the normal approximation works poorly for a small sample size or for a very high or very low p. So what you want is for n times p and n times 1 minus p to be greater than 10. That's kind of a rule of thumb. When that's satisfied, then you can use the normal approximation. Otherwise, it's not a good idea. Okay, so to summarize, what we have to remember is, first of all, the difference between a parameter and a statistic. That is, a parameter is a characteristic of the population. It's unknown. Statistic is a value in a sample, and we do know it. Know the difference between a biased and an unbiased statistic. An unbiased statistic will, on average, equal the value of the parameter. A biased statistic will not. So you can increase the sample size all you want, and a biased statistic doesn't get any better. But if you have an unbiased statistic, then the more you increase the sample size, the smaller the error gets, the smaller the expected error will be on the statistic versus the true unknown population parameter. The central limit theorem states that. It states that the sampling error, regardless of the underlying distribution, the sampling error becomes normal with a large enough sample size. Typically 30 is a rule of thumb for that, for a large enough sample size. And the mean is the true population mean. The standard deviation is the true population standard deviation divided by the square root of the sample size. So the error falls with the square root of the sample size, at least the standard error. Know how to use the formula, z equals x bar minus mu over sigma over square root of n. And finally, know how to use the normal approximation to binomial where you replace, in some sense, you replace x bar with p hat, you replace mu with p, and you replace sigma with square root of p times 1 minus p, and then you're just off and running using the previous normal formula. That's it.